Blog Talk Radio.
Because this device here to lower the music, and it's always been problematic, but, you know, I started lowering it at that point where you wanted me to lower it at, you know, and it did nothing. And then I kept lowering it by notch and notch and notch and nothing, and finally I just had to turn it off. I mean, lower
it. Listen, we'll just do it like this. Welcome aboard to this edition of History Day, in case you missed it. This is Paul Angel and your co-host, Dave Gaheri, coming to you live from Virginia and Florida. So, Dave, lots of stuff still happening in the news, lots of stuff going on with this Confederate stuff. I keep talking about it because it just galls me. But
you should keep talking about it.
Yeah. I guess people are interested in this subject because we do get emails, we do get comments. There's a lot of people. We're pretty upset about this. As I mentioned in my last show, there's people marching out here and displaying the flag, and people are coming up with the rainbow flag and the Raza flag. And I say, hey, fantastic, as long as you can have an open dialogue about the thing, not have it devolve into a shouting match and violence with so far.
Well, yeah. Wait a second, Paul.
So far seems what? So far, it seems encouraging that we are having people out here standing up for their heritage.
Well, did you hear about those folks that got a gun pulled on them?
Oh, no, I did not hear about that. I've heard a lot of other stuff going on behind the scenes here, going on the property, pulling down private flags. Tell me about this other incident, Dave.
Yeah, these folks in your state, Virginia, in Chesterfield County. I don't know if you know where that is.
That's out there, I think.
Virginia's huge, but anyway, in Chesterfield County, Virginia, an Amelia man, I don't know where that is, but was charged with brandishing a firearm after he pointed a gun at a Chesterfield family who was waving Confederate flags on Hull Street Road outside of their Mosley home, police said. So this fellow, James Baker, I don't think any relation to the infamous James A. Baker III. James Baker, 46, was released following his arrest on the Class 1 misdemeanor. Well, that's pretty interesting when you brandish a firearm. And not only that, I watched the video of this poor family where they said he slammed on the brakes. And when he got right beside me, he pulled out a gun, chambered a round, and told me my cause wasn't worth anything now. He got out of the car and took three steps towards me, and the gun was maybe 6 inches off my head. And this was in front of his children. So you got to wonder about the race of this person who did this, because, and it's very clear, the authorities across this once great nation treat the races differently when it comes to charges, criminal charges. Now, here's a guy who pulled out a gun, chambered around, put it 6 inches from the guy's head, threatened him, and he got a Class 1 misdemeanor.
Well, maybe I'm wrong. I think it's good that people are out there and they need not to be intimidated, but that's a scary situation right there. I mean, pulling a gun right there on your family, I imagine that it would be one of these thuggish types. Hard to believe it would be a business suit black guy who would come out there and not understand a little bit more about it. But listen, man, standing up for yourself is a dangerous job, and standing up for the truth is a dangerous job. And so people have to feel comfortable with what they're doing. I think that this is all the more reason why groups like the Foundation and the First Amendment need to support these private flag groups that raise their flag up. This isn't just a stroll in the park here. This is an important time in our history. And we either try to get the truth out about this and make a little bit of a stand, or we roll over like every white politician practically, I won't say all, have rolled over in the South to make sure that they're on the right side of political correctness. But, you know, man, it just goes to show you that these symbols are important to people. They're powerful things. And, you know, and I just keep thinking to myself, what's next? What's next? I mean, look at another.
Well, before you go into that, Paul, remember this.
Yes.
Because don't forget what you were going to say. All right. You want to give me the topic so we can go back to it? Or?
Well, it really doesn't matter, because if I forget what I was going to say, I'm sure I'll have something else I can
say. It does matter, because I hate doing that. But
it's okay. We were going to talk about, I'm just going to segue into another news item.
Go ahead, okay. Well, remember that news item. What's it about, anyway?
Of the church shootings.
Okay, yes. Now, you're originally from Maryland, right?
That's correct.
Okay, you were talking about gutless politicians, right?
Absolutely.
Okay. So did you know now that in July of 2015, and I think we could say July of 2015, because if we just say 2015, it doesn't mean much considering how fast things are happening, and the news is just every day there's something new. I mean, they're going to ban pretty soon, you know, people holding their hands to their hearts because it represents a racist ideology. But here, you're from Maryland, born and bred, I guess, and I guess the governor of Maryland, this guy Martin O'Malley, he was at a some kind of an event.
Ex-governor. He's running for president now.
Ex-governor, right. Some kind of event on Saturday, just 2 days ago, and discussing police violence against blacks. And there were liberal demonstrators there. It was a Netroots Nation conference, a gathering of liberal activists. And, of course, it's just not blacks. It's these white liberal fools. They were there also. So they're shouting, Black Lives Matter. And O'Malley responded, Black Lives Matter, White Lives Matter, All Lives Matter. Well, guess what, Paul? The demonstrators, who were mostly black, responded by booing him and shouting him down. And guess what he did later that day?
He apologized.
That's correct.
Good for him. Now he has a chance in politics.
So we can really say now that only black lives matter to these white politicians. O'Malley's white, right?
Well, listen, that poor dean, I think, at some school, or a history teacher with lots of tenure, had said the same silly thing, the idea that everybody's lives matter. But it's just not part of it. It's not part of the narrative, as we say. It's not part of the accepted rhetoric right now. You know, when will white lives matter? I guess when we're the vast minority. I'll come back to the church shooting. I won't forget, but there was something here that John Tiffany over at the Barnes & Noble sent me, and it was, I think, a statement somebody had made, probably just an average citizen. Slavery today, he called it. And some 160 years ago, the white people sat in the porch, drank mint juleps, and watched the black people do the work that needed to be done so the whites could live the life they wanted. The blacks didn't produce enough to keep the whites happy. They complained about it. Maybe got a little stern and physical. In those days, it was called slavery. But time passes, and today, many black people are sitting on their butts drinking Thunderbird to watch the white people work to pay the taxes that are necessary for the black people to live the life they want. Their welfare check is not enough to keep them happy, and they complain about it. Maybe even loot and burn. What is it called today? Freedom. It would appear to me, he says, that the only thing that really has changed in the last 160 years has been the color of the slaves. Well, that's a bit overstated, but I think it makes the point that at what point in time, can we say enough is enough here? White lives do matter, black lives matter, but if black lives really mattered, I think that black leaders would get inside these communities be honest with themselves and honest to get on the media, if the media wouldn't censor their comments, to point out that the worst enemy of any young black man is probably the young black man down the street who might be on the wrong side of the criminal fence, and that so many hundreds of thousands, what do we say, 300,000 or 400,000
right,
blacks have killed each other in this country in the past, say, 30 years. We think the number might be higher because there's a lot of unsolved ones and homicides, et cetera. But this is a genocide of immense proportion in which we're looking at this honestly. The United Nations would probably be in this country, in some of the inner cities, occupying these poverty-stricken areas to prevent the carnage. I don't know how many Tutsis and Hutus killed each other in Central Africa, maybe in the millions, but you're talking over 30 years, half of this, you know, and of course it may not have been quite as brutal, I understand, in Africa. They hack your limbs off and torture you and all this other stuff, but I mean, as we've seen here, we've had white people tortured. Sure, we've had blacks tortured by their fellow blacks. We've had shootings, trips to the hospital, threats, intimidation. It's something that I think is a much worse problem for the black community to overcome than the few and far between white racist cops that exist. Not to say that cops shouldn't haven't gone in a particular direction over the past 25 years, we'll say, towards being militarized, but that's all part of the program. I can't blame them for going to classes. I can't blame them for buying into the whole thing that the average citizen now is the enemy, and they are an occupying force as well. But anyway, and that brings us to the news media. Why doesn't the news media talk about this? Well, now we've had this huge run of publicity. I think it's died down recently. And by the way, I know you don't watch TV, but this is one of the reasons you kind of got to watch it, just to see what they're not saying and what they are saying, to reconvince yourself if you ever had any doubt, or an average person that has any doubt, that what you're getting on the mainstream newspapers and mainstream newscasts on television and even on the radio is just pure censored propaganda. And go ahead and look at what they're saying about these black church burnings. I don't have the exact figures in front of me, but Dave, if you can pull up the last issue of American Free Press, how long will that take you?
That will take me, let's see, 5, 4, 3, 2, 1. Okay.
The story's on page 4, I believe, or is it 6? So
I will tell you in a sec.
Go to page 6 and read that for us. It's only 500 words. You have a beautiful voice. Read that story.
Oh, God, that's what I want to do, is read this story. Which you know what? I have to read this story.
Well, we can. You need to read a paragraph.
Ready?
If there's anything you want to comment on, stop there, or I'll stop
right.
You.
All right, you just stop me. Okay, black church burning hysteria. That's right. That's on page 8. Yellow journalists are crying racism, but are they really just crying wolf? By John Tiffany. The mainstream media is on a roll, reporting that in the aftermath of the Charleston church shooting. I guess we have to say alleged Charleston church shooting, because we weren't there. I wasn't there. Were you there, Paul?
No.
No. Okay, so we really don't know what happened. There's been a rash of church arsons in black churches in the South, and that racists are behind it. Writers on the internet have fueled the fire, calling attention to 6 incidents at predominantly black churches in the South recently. Many criticized what they claimed was the lack of media coverage to the so-called story, but what is the truth about these, and is someone really committing arson? The short answer is no. Take the fire at Mount Zion African Methodist Church in Greeleyville, South Carolina. The building burned to the ground, but it turned out to be caused by lightning, not arson. Church fires are surprisingly common, regardless whether black, white, or mixed, and in most cases, it is not arson. In fact, nationwide, there are an average of 34 church fires per week. This writer's own church had a bad fire a couple of years ago and nearly was totaled. Church was mostly white, but a Hispanic congregation that also used the building had neglected to put out all the candles, causing the blaze. There has, in fact, been considerable media hoopla about the notion that racists are burning black churches. There are some 890 stories on the Greeleyville fire alone. Too much media coverage, really, on a fire caused by lightning. Reuters relayed the news that a fire inside a mostly black church in Macon, Georgia, has been ruled as arson by fire officials, local newspaper The Telegraph reported. The arson ruling came a day after North Carolina authorities said a predominantly black church in Charlotte was purposely burned, and roughly a week after a white gunman opened fire, allegedly, in an African-American church in Charleston, South Carolina, killing 9 people. The shooting came amid months of intense debate over U.S. race relations and a renewed civil rights movement after unarmed black men were killed by police officers in Ferguson, Missouri, Baltimore, Maryland, and elsewhere. The truth is, however, Macon Bibb County Fire Sergeant Ben Gleaton said the investigation is still continuing and there is nothing yet to indicate the fire at the Macon Church was a hate crime, editorialized the Washington Post. It is not wrong to worry that the recent fires are the latest in a long line of hate. If Dylann Roof's solo crusade in the name of white supremacy did not start the race war he yearned for, the subsequent backlash against a Confederate battle flag does seem to have invigorated racist groups. It's hard to watch hatred surge and churches burn in so short a span of time and not wonder if the two are related. Investigators should deliver answers as quickly as they can. A Baltimore Sun editorial expressed concern about a mysterious series of fires at African-American churches across the South in the wake of the Charleston shootings, as if it were a case of history repeating itself. The Sun cited an uptick in attacks on 37 black churches in the South in the 1990s that prompted President Bill Clinton to set up a church arson investigative task force. The newspaper failed to mention that Clinton had falsely claimed at the time that he had, quote, vivid and painful memories of black churches being burned in my own state when I was a child, an assertion promptly debunked by the Arkansas Democrat Citizen. The yellow press coverage that launched the 1990s media hysteria was sparked by fearmonger Gary Fields, who scribbled 61 Stampede the Lemmings stories in USA Today on supposed black church arson. Now history is repeating in the current juggernaut of white supremacist arson tales, but as a history of establishment media lying, not of churches burning. The Fields fabrication fell apart under serious scrutiny, and USA Today had to admit, quote, analysis of the 64 fires since 1995 shows only 4 can be conclusively shown to be racially motivated. Says conservative writer Michelle Malkin, several of the hyped hate crimes against black churches have been committed by black suspects. A significant number of the black churches are in fact white churches, and the complex motives included mental illness, vandalism, and concealment of theft, added Malkin. The last thing the community and our country need are hysterical journalists compounding the pain with inflammatory reporting on an unsubstantiated epidemic of black church arsons. Confirmation bias is a psychological phenomenon whereby people seek out information that seems to confirm their existing opinions and ignore information that goes against their prejudices. To be charitable rather than say the media are outright lying, we could say these, quote, prostitutes are victims of confirmation bias. Their minds are already made up, so do not confuse them with the facts. A black church burns in the South, and without evidence, the mind of a northern liberal immediately turns to racial hatred as the likely cause, and the liberal media has brainwashed the average American to the point that every shooting or bombing conjures up the idea of a terrorist act. Last paragraph. In truth, church fires have been on the decline for several decades, according to the National Fire Protection Association. I guess they would know. Only about 1 in 6 fires at black churches is intentional, and only a fraction of those are racially motivated. Half of those arrested for such arsons are younger than 18, suggesting that stupidity and youthful indiscretion are a major cause. Also, since churches are a symbol of authority, attacking them might be a way for thrill-seeking young teens to rebel against society. And before you comment on this, Paul, I just want to say, this is why American Free Press is so important. I'm done.
My point, exactly, pretty much. What's the truth? Why are they focusing on this particular story? Why are they weaving fictional stories about it before they have all the facts in? We talk about this all the time, but the mainstream media seems to be greater and bigger and more powerful than ever as far as molding people's minds. Here's one, and the cover coverage of Trayvon Martin and Michael Brown and Freddie Gray and all these other stories have been spun one way or another into an anti-white narrative that the cops have to be white. Of course, after we found out in Baltimore that I think more than half of the cops involved in that guy who was arrested there at that time, I think he had an illegal weapon, but they knew who he was and what he'd been doing. He'd been doing it, they've been arrested 24 times. He'd been a plague on that society, in that inner city. They had never, as far as I know, on the mainstream media, a lot of people know the truth about his arrest record, but I still don't really, I've never seen anything about it. But of course, that all died down once half the cops were black. And so that makes a point about police brutality, but they never really corrected the record on that being a white crime, a totally white crime against a young black man. At any rate, so what's their agenda is the question. And the agenda evidently seems to be to stir up troubles between the races let's be honest, Dave, with the ultimate purpose of controlling or brainwashing or splitting the white population. This Confederate flag issue is interesting because, as we pointed out, I think Chris Peppert pointed out, the editor of AFP on the last show, that a lot of Northerners don't seem to care about this particular issue. They're not wedded to the Southern flag, any of the different ones that they're flying, and they don't particularly have the pride in that flag that they did. And the Northerners see the Civil War as a different thing anyway. They just see it as the bringing a bunch of rebellious people to heel and keeping the United States together, as opposed to Southerners who see it as a real stand against federal tyranny. And so, you know, Northerners need to, as we said last program, to watch out what's coming next. And we mentioned that statue of the Jesuit, the priest, black robe, is being removed. Okay, this is an assault against white Christian culture, and there's no a larger density, I suppose, of white Christians than there is in the South, especially ones that can be so easily smeared and pigeonholed as racists and throwbacks to an era when there was slavery. So this church burning thing seems to me just part of a pattern of inflaming people against one another for whatever purpose it is. I always want to know who thrives on mayhem the best, and what good does it really do, even those we normally point a finger at, to have rioting and businesses burning and smoke coming up from cities, except fear. You know, it's got a lot of white people afraid that things like this are going to come to their neighborhood. And of course, then on the heels of the news that Mr. Obama has still pursuing, although Congress is resisting, this high-density minority housing in the midst of, well, generally speaking, either high class or middle class black or white neighborhoods, you know, it's got them concerned that we are in the midst of fighting Civil War III. Now, I know you're going out to go do this League of the South rally pretty soon here, but I saw League of the South, if you're up on this, just had another one, didn't they? Didn't they have some type of rally?
Yeah, no, it's not a rally. It's their annual convention. Okay. Although there will be a demonstration,
right,
in the streets.
Well, you're going to that one, but didn't they just have some other event, or perhaps they always have events in which I saw that there was a clash between black and white. We'll call them protesters somewhere. Legally.
Yes,
and that it was billed as a KKK rally. Do you know anything about this League of the South event?
Well, there was a KKK event this past weekend.
Okay.
And that was in South Carolina.
Okay.
But as far as the League of the South, yeah, there are chapters in, I think, how many Southern states are there during the Civil War? I think there were,
13.
12? Okay, 13. Okay.
13 seceded, I believe. There may have been some border ones that didn't get a chance to. Maryland was one.
Oh, by the way, I wanted to tell you, I had ordered that book after you mentioned it a couple weeks ago, Starving the South, and I got it, and I'm reading it right now. Interesting stuff there.
That was a good one. Yeah, and there was also War Crimes Against Southern Civilians, which was an absolutely horrific book. To learn the truth of what, besides Americans shooting one another in military uniforms, but to see what U.S. troops will do to civilians. And this is, you know, this whole assault against the South. It's just, is it all coincidental that it's all happened so recently that we're now having these jade helm exercises almost exclusively, I think, in southern or southwestern states? And, you know, that's why these people are antsy down there. And I know that Michael Hill over at the League of the South had written a nice editorial about white people need to watch out what they get provoked into now, because all they're looking for is another incident to vilify any other section of white society that they haven't figured out how to vilify. Maybe it's white Northerners who are now looked upon a lot differently than white Southerners. Of course, slavery was still legal in the northern states, and there were still slaveholders during the Civil War there. And so, and we also know that a lot of the people in the far north are as racist as anybody could possibly find anywhere in the South.
That's right. In New Jersey, there's a big contingent of KKK people. So.
Yeah, I don't even know what the KKK is doing anymore. I read one time that recently, FBI, I think it was, said that there were very few chapters left, that they had diminished. I wonder if all part of this is to reinvigorate that. We know that this is a great vehicle for the FBI to infiltrate through chapters like this. I remember the shocking story that I think it was from Assad or AIPAC or all these lobbies working together with intelligence had funded one of the largest KKK chapters in America for many years, because they got the most virulent types of people out there, the ones who would scream the worst defamations they could against blacks and to make them look as horrible as possible. And other KKK chapters were like, who the heck are these guys? They're hardcore. Well, it turns out they're being funded by or maybe it was the SPLC, who knows, they work hand in glove.
That's a love group in Alabama.
Okay, so
the SPLC. Right.
So here's if you have whites feeling threatened and they feel like they want to do something, but they don't know what to do by themselves, they figure maybe a peaceful rallies or displays of symbols of Southern culture might be a positive way to do this. And all of a sudden, there's an increase in the number of whites who join these groups. Well, then bigger and more vocal KKK chapters is only going to mean bigger and more vocal newspaper stories on how horrible they are. It just seems like everything's being used to rile everybody up to the point where we're at each other's throats. So
it also might be the last dying gasps of the elite media, the mainstream media, because it's clear that television viewership is way down for these news, quote unquote, news outlets. And they might be just desperate for viewers and going the way of the what are those magazines in the supermarkets, the National Enquirer, right?
Right, right.
Yeah,
right. The Globe, I think.
Yeah, right. They might be going the way of those papers, because they're losing an audience, and if they can stretch the truth really far, obviously, after reading that article that we just did, if they can stretch the truth, and, you know, people want to believe in this crap, you know, they want to believe that there's, you know, people in white hoods, you know, in your own neighborhood waiting to lynch the, you know, the innocent black guy who has done nothing, when the fact of the matter is, and they don't talk about this, that there's blacks opening fire right in broad daylight on cops in Missouri now. So, they don't want to talk about that, or they don't want to talk about what we've mentioned before about the guy pulling the gun on these people. All they were doing was waving the Confederate flag on the side of the road. So maybe it is not so much that they have an agenda, but their agenda is to get an audience.
Yeah, I haven't taken a look recently at their ratings to see. I'm interested to see the demographics of people watching the news. Has there been an uptick in black viewership because of the coverage of black issues, which has been increased? And if so, would there be more marketing dedicated towards the black audience? You know, the black Americans do spend money, and they're an extremely important part of the economy as far as that goes. And I remember seeing that, you know, Google and everybody else will say, and advertisers are doing a very good job these days, figuring out what exactly you're going to buy. It was a scary thing. I had dinner with a friend of mine this weekend, and we met out on, and the reason that spurred this program, we haven't gotten there yet, but it was a restaurant off John S. Mosby Highway in, I think it was Loudoun, and we were talking about him getting on to Google, and he likes Tesla cars and Tesla products. Well, he's been stationed overseas, but he happened to have made on his Google calendar notations that he would be in the United States for the 30 days of July. And here, and they know where he was staying. And so he gets an alert that Tesla car company was having a big symposium or something in Cumberland, Maryland, okay, we'll say. And it's like, that's almost scary. Google knows where you're going to be, what you're looking for, and what's on your calendar.
Only because you let them know.
Yeah, well, that's right. I don't use Google Calendar. I would love to have a Facebook page, but I really don't want to have that Facebook thing going on and having pictures of me. I guess I could have pictures of me running around historical sites or whatever. But anyway, while we were having dinner on an unrelated subject, but on that, to Google, but related to our subject today, he says, what's up with John S. Mosby Highway? And I said, you don't know about John S. Mosby, the Gray Ghost? Back when we were kids, Dave, Disney had lots of programs, history programs, which just seem to be completely gone now. I mean, we used to watch Daniel Boone, Davy Crockett, The Gray Ghost, which was the a show about a Confederate raider, okay, a cavalryman, on mainstream TV. I am absolutely sure that the old Gray Ghost wouldn't have a shot of being on any television.
Or never.
Now, maybe it's on some... maybe on some old throwback television program. Guaranteed it'll be off of there soon. But the guy's name, let's see, what was his name? Yeah, it was on for, well, it was only on for 1 year. So maybe it wasn't that popular. But it was in 1957 and 1958. I'm like, where have those historical programs gone? Where have those sweet family-oriented programs gone? They are gone. They are just vanished. I don't know if they... Made us not want them anymore, if you know what I mean by that.
Right.
Meaning they just didn't market them anymore. There wasn't money in them, or if there's just something else going on there. But that was one of the programs. And so who is John S. Mosby? Well, John S. Mosby was a Confederate cavalry raider at first, and later on, I think he rose to the ranks to become a colonel. He started off as a private, and he operated here in Virginia and bedeviled the Union Army for at least 4 or 5 years. I guess it was across 5 Aprils, so April from the Civil War's 4 years, 1861 to 1865. But at any rate, and how he got his nickname, the Gray Ghost, of course, is he could appear out of nowhere and then disappear just as quickly back in the mist or the fog or the rain or the forest and just disappear. People here in this section of Virginia still call it Mosby's Confederacy. Once he would, and his troops would escape to this area, any number of Southerners would give them shelter, food, whatever else. At any rate, the Barnes Review a few years back published Mosby's memoirs. You know, guys from that era, and particularly Southerners, I think, were extremely well educated in the vein of Thomas Jefferson, perhaps not to that level, because Jefferson was could speak French and Greek and Latin and English and was any number of the types of scientists and geologists and photographer, archaeologists, you know. But these guys were smart, and when they wrote, they made references to all kinds of classical motifs, et cetera, et cetera. So it just reading this book brought to light, brought to focus how intelligent people were in the United States at the time, but also just this particular guy was extremely intelligent and also a military tactician. Now, he and three of the great raiders of the Civil War on the Confederate side were Mosby, John Hunt Morgan, and Jeb Stuart. I'm trying to think who the other one was. May not be Jeb Stuart, but he was another cavalry. And they practically, he was famous. He was the eyes of Lee's army. But these guys rewrote warfare as we see it today, as from a guerrilla standpoint, hit and run raids, hitting supply lines. And so they're still being studied, their tactics. And I don't know if they're going to be able to kill that, but in West Point, but they're. Some tactics of these guys in Mosby are still being studied today by our soldiers. So what they had to offer to the historical record is important. Whether or not they're going to be, next time I go to that restaurant, if it's going to be the Maya Angelou Parkway, I'm not sure. But for now, people in this state are extremely proud of the accomplishments of Mosby, his legacy of courage, standing up to the police state, standing up to Lincoln's police state, standing up to federal tyranny, protecting the people in the area, and just a lost chivalry in warfare that it certainly doesn't exist today. You killed a man close up back in those days. I guess sharpshooters did. Men, you might fire at each other a few volleys, but a lot of this stuff was hand-to-hand. And if you captured men, he didn't torture them, generally speaking. He didn't assassinate them. There were real rules to war that are broken all the time now on both sides. ISIS, I think, a different set of rules, we'll say, and than Westerners have. But even the Western way of fighting now is kind of a sporadic way, an unfocused way. I might think that these smart bombs can kill is just exactly what you wanted to kill. Well, we kill women and children all the time, you know, and we've killed women and children for many years. This was just a taboo thing on the Confederate side, anyway, during the Civil War, but certainly not on the Union side, as you're going to find out, excuse me, starting the South and war crimes against Southern civilians. But let me read from the introduction to this book, and then I am going to read a few things if we have enough time, about what Mosby had to say about General Robert E. Lee and General Grant, because these guys also, at the very end of the war, most of the generals and politicians knew that to move forward as a nation, we were going to have to go through a severe and abrupt healing process, and that the longer we drew out the hatreds that had been generated amongst some in the Civil War, the longer it was going to take to heal and the more fractured this nation was going to remain. At any rate, here comes the foreword to Tracking the Gray Ghost, Colonel John S. Mosby, from the book The Memoirs of Colonel John Singleton Mosby. Interrupt me at any time if you want to make a comment, Dave.
Okay.
The heroic John Singleton Mosby eluded the efforts of Union troops to capture him throughout the war against the South, earning him the nickname of the Gray Ghost. Special counter-partisan units were organized to squash him. One such force faced off against Mosby in West Virginia. The guerrillas defeated the unit and captured its leader. At the end of the war, Mosby was one of the few Confederate leaders who never surrendered, although he was ordered to do so. He remains an inspiration to all patriotic young men, and his tactics are studied even today. The Gray Ghost was a guerrilla fighter for the South and was so successful in his endeavors that if he were to be captured, he and any of his Rangers were to be hanged on the spot. This reflected the fear the Feds had of Mosby. He was so victorious that he tied up thousands of Federals throughout Northern Virginia in their terror that the U.S. president might be in jeopardy. A true hero, Mosby was greatly respected among other Confederates. With all of his exposure to danger during his many daring raids, he was never caught. However, General Robert E. Lee, who was a close friend, observed that Mosby's only fault is that he was always getting wounded. He was wounded 6 times during the war. Mosby was born in 1833 in Powhatan County, Virginia, and died at age 82, May 30, 1916, on Memorial Day. I'm going to skip a little bit ahead, where we talk about his childhood, and we're going to go to the war period. Mosby's mentor was General Jeb Stuart, for whom he did some scouting work early on in the war. Just Stewart recognized Mosby's talent and gave him orders to form Company A, 43rd Battalion of Virginia Cavalry, better known as Mosby's Rangers. The initial troop consisted of 9 men, which later grew to 400 Rangers. He preferred young men between 17 to 20 years of age, for they were so willing to obey, as well as being a little naive to the dangers they were about to face. As an aside, they're also in a lot better shape. You start wearing out about 28 in war zone when you're running around, staying up 24 hours, getting shot at. Anyway, he saw the advantage of having partisan rangers, not regulars. This approach would entitle his men to the spoils of war. Many accumulated enough to buy farms at the end of the war. And their youth never hindered their effectiveness. This reflected the leadership of Mosby. Mosby's practice was to keep the Rangers in the dark about his plans until the last minute. His choice of weapons was Colt 44, preferring a handgun or a rifle or saber. Each Ranger was to have at least 2 handguns, but many carried as many as 4, 5, or 6 revolvers. Often, when leading a charge, Mosby would use a horn, the horn kind of horn they use in the fox hunt out here in Virginia country. His guerrilla warfare was mainly in Virginia's Loudoun and Fauquier counties, from Aldi to the Shenandoah Valley, an area of many fox hunts. Today, Route 50 runs up the middle of his territory, with the terrain and many buildings the same that Mosby viewed as he was driving the Union forces towards oblivion. In nearly all of his engagements, he was greatly outnumbered. The Mosby campaign lasted 28 months, but in that time he drove those Yankees mad. He would attack without warning and as quickly disappear. This enraged the North. His reputation grew. There was one close encounter when he faked his death by smearing his blood from a wound. He was effective in this, for the Union forces left him for dead. After his recovery, he suddenly appeared on the battlefield, and once again, the Federals had to admit that he truly was the Gray Ghost. An event did happen to him when he was a young man, which forever changed his life. He was a small man, about 5'6", 5'7", about 125, 135 pounds. So he's a little guy. But so because of his size, this foreword says, he was subject when young to being bullied. This came to a head while a student at Virginia University. The campus bully, named George Turpin, was angered at fellow student Mosby when some musicians played for Mosby's party instead of Turpin's. By the way, the legend of this goes back. Some people say it was a woman that had been insulted. But anyway, as was his modus operandi, Turpin would verbally threaten to beat one up at the next encounter. In one case, he nearly killed a fellow student. Mosby, not one to back down, replied to this threat, accepting the beating that would follow. But this time, he packed an old pepper box pistol for the confrontation. And when Turpin rushed him, Mosby shot him in the neck, which reflected his sense of justice, as even the judge later acknowledged. Turpin recovered. But Mosby served 9 months in jail and was fined $500. However, he was later pardoned by the governor. Now, at first, Mosby told a friend that he was going to fight for the Union. But after Lincoln rallied up 75,000 volunteers to invade the South, Mosby decided he was going to become a pure Southerner. And so when the vote came for secession, even though in the previous times Mosby had spoken out against secession, he knew what was going to happen. That this was going to be a bloody and protracted affair, but most of the people in the South were certainly hoping that he'd get it over with quickly, and the North didn't happen. Anyway, when the vote came for secession in Fauquier County, there were only 4 votes not to secede. A famous and glamorous and classic example of guerrilla warfare was when Mosby, on March 8, 1863, at Fairfax Courthouse, captured Brigadier General Edwin H. Stoughton, a West Point graduate from a prominent family in Vermont. As Mosby awoke him out of bed, the general angrily shouted at him, "Do you know who I am?" Mosby replied, "I reckon I do, General. Did you ever hear of Mosby?" "Yes," the general says. "Have you caught him?" "No, but he has caught you," answered Mosby. One of Mosby's great accomplishments was rousting out that and several other high-ranking officers right out of the middle of their Union camp. Anyway, he had captured Brigadier General, 30 men, 58 horses, all without firing a shot or losing a man, and all this was done among 3,500 Federals. The odds that great, it appears that he might have had some help from above. Another of his daring experiences was his escape from the feds at Hathaway House. somehow the Yankees had gotten word that he was visiting the Hathaways. They were friends, and local Virginia planters, you know, they would love to entertain Confederate officers and show their appreciation. Their daughters would meet them. They'd dance all night and have a ball, perhaps. But obviously, it's tough to keep such things quiet. So they were at the Hathaways. And after surrounding the house at midnight, feds knocked on the door of the house, and they entered the home, and they said they were searching for Mosby. They knocked on all the bedroom doors, and a lieutenant came up from Pauline and John's bedroom. I may be wrong. Pauline was his wife. Pauline may have been a Hathaway, I'm not sure, because they were married at this time, but they came from Pauline and John's bedroom. And Pauline was 3 months pregnant at the time with John Singleton Mosby Jr. But her demeanor was enough, it says here, that it allowed John just enough time to climb out the window and on a limb of a large walnut tree, staying there for some 8 hours up in the tree on that summer night of June 8, 1863. And if you know your history, you know that Gettysburg's are coming within about a month. In spite of the fact that spurs were found in the bedroom and his horse was discovered, Mosby never was. In the providence of God, their bedroom was conveniently located next to that walnut tree. One of the advantages of being a guerrilla is that the spoils for the victory went to the guerrillas. In 28 months of guerrilla fighting, Mosby and his Rangers captured 3,500 horses and mules and a great number of weapons and were responsible for over 2,900 Union casualties, 4 prisoners. Mosby would award the best horses captured to those who demonstrated the greatest bravery in battle. The going rate in 1863 was $110 for a cavalry horse, $12 for a revolver, and $10 for a rifle. So a ranger could earn himself about $132 by capturing one Union cavalryman, which was more than a year's pay for a private. Often Mosby himself was paid in gold. One of the easiest sources of spoils was when they captured a sutler. That's a civilian who sells supplies to the soldiers on the field. They bring up their sutler's wagon, home in a chuck wagon. So what would happen then, it says here, this is one of the more pleasurable events in the life of the Rangers. They shared the spoils, which often included a variety of items, pots, pans, food. On a rare occasion, Mosby would participate in sharing the spoils and the celebration that went with it. One of the more impressive raids was when the Rangers derailed a train, blew up the boiler with a large weapon they had captured, and took much spoils, including $174,000 in cash. Those Rangers insisted he take his share, Mosby refused. The men then took up a collection of $10,000 and they gave it to Pauline, his wife. He then returned it to the troops as a Christmas present. And in return, they gave him a prize horse named Coquette that had been much admired earlier. Mosby had the integrity of George Washington, ethics that are completely contrary to what is in Washington, D.C. today. America's war between the states was one of the cruelest wars in history, as we all know, with much bloodshed, tears, and heartache. Says here that over 625,000 men and 1.5 million horses were killed. After Mosby greatly embarrassed General Phil Sheridan in the wagon raid of August 13, 1864, in and around Berryville, Virginia, Sheridan suffered great loss of wagons and their supplies, and desire to flush out Mosby increased. This resulted in the burning raid, November 1864, when General Sheridan, a confident Union cavalry general, by the way, he set up a hunter-killer team of 100 men under the leadership of Captain Richard Blazer with one mission, that was to go kill or capture Mosby and his Rangers. The Union troops went up the valley, Shenandoah, I imagine, using the terror tactic of mass destruction of civilian property. Homes were burned, barns were burned, horses were killed, crops and livestock were slaughtered, looted, taken with the troops by the Union. All private valuables were ripped out of the houses. Women and children were intimidated. I don't know if on this particular raid, how physical they got. I know that Sherman's March through the Sea was an atrocity. But at any rate, back to this, Mosby and his Rangers were not flushed out. This cruel tactic was once again used by the Union forces here it is right here, when General Sherman catastrophically marched to the sea, burning Atlanta on the way. And wrapping up this introduction to this particular Memoirs of Mosby book, says, John Singleton Mosby was involved in the First Battle of Manassas, Bull Run, and his exploits ended after General Robert E. Lee surrendered on April 9, 1865, at Appomattox Courthouse. Colonel Mosby never surrendered, but he disbanded the 43rd Battalion at Salem, which is now Marshall, Virginia. And here was his farewell address to his men. Soldiers, I have summoned you together for the last time. The vision we have cherished for a free and independent country has vanished, and that country is now the spoil of a conqueror. I disband your organization in preference to surrendering it to our enemies. I am no longer your commander. After an association of more than two eventful years, I part from you with a just pride in the fame of your achievements and grateful recollections of your generous kindness to myself. And now, at this moment of bidding, your final adieu, accept the assurance of my unchanging confidence in regard, Colonel John S. Mosby, CAA, CSA, excuse me, 43rd Battalion, Virginia Cavalry. Listen, Dave, they were so scared of Mosby in Washington, D.C. That night, they would pull the planks up off the bridges for fear that somehow he would slip past thousands of troops and guards and kidnap President Lincoln. The guy was really amazing. But as I said, one of the things about him was his intellect. Here's a guy. He came from a well-off family, I believe. His father died when he was a child, though. And they were poverty-stricken for a while. I think his wife remarried. Whatever, through good business moves, he got himself back up and was no dummy. He had attended some decent schools. And so at the time, it's just amazing reading back on what he says about things. And some of the classical references he made, there was one in here about a shirt of something, and I didn't know it was a shirt that had killed Hercules in the, I think it's the shirt of Nestor, or Nessor, one or the other. Nessor was a centaur, and they had taken the centaur's blood, which was poison, and they had put it on the shirt, and then the bad guy gave it to Hercules, and he put it on and killed it. And I'm like, who knows the reference that these guys knew? How smart these guys were? How much smarter are they?
And how stupid are we today?
And I even have to say we, because I didn't know there were some of these references. But others, as we know, are even, I hate to say it, dumber than you and I, which is hard to believe sometimes, but
right.
They are, and they don't even care. At least we care. I'm going to read a little bit of a section here about the Greenback Raid. This comes from Mosby's own words and sometimes through his letters, and then he'll connect the messages in the letters. I'll try to skip over the uneventful portions, but basically throughout the fall and winter of 1864, Mosby was just incessantly attacking and raiding on Sheridan and trying to break his communications and gather intelligence to help Robert E. Lee, and Stonewall Jackson was gone by this point. He had, I think, the Battle of Chancellorsville was 1864, I'm not sure, but it was a great loss. But Mosby also mentions Jackson, what a great, great man Stonewall Jackson was. Now, here's a letter they wrote near Middleburg. Middleburg's a very, so we say, antique area around here, up in, I think, Loudon, north of us in Stafford, in which you said they mentioned earlier, you still see these old taverns and they're very proud of their past. But here's near Middleburg, and he writes a letter. My dearest Pauline, I have been engaged in a perpetual strife with the Yankees ever since my arrival. They are now engaged in repairing the railroad that I attacked recently and destroyed. I just recently attacked the camp of 800. We operated in Sheridan's rear. The railroad that brought his supplies was his weak point, and consequently our favorite object of attack. For security, it had to be closely guarded by detachments of troops, which materially reduced the Union's offensive strength. We kept watch for unguarded points, and the opportunity they offered was never lost. Early in October, one of my best men, Jim Wiltshire, afterwards a prominent physician in Baltimore, discovered and reported to me a gap through which we might penetrate between the guards and reach that railroad without exciting an alarm. It was a hazardous enterprise, as there were camps along the line and frequent communication between them. But I knew it would injure Sheridan, destroy a train, compel him to place a stronger guard on the road. So I resolved to take the risk. Wiltshire had a timetable. We knew the minute when the train was due. And so timed our arrival that we would not have to wait long. There was a great danger of our being discovered, but the patrols on the road and our presence reported to the camps that were near. The situation was critical. We were so buoyant with hope, we did not realize it. The westernbound passenger train was selected from the schedule, as I knew it would create a greater sensation to burn it than any other. It was due about 2 o'clock in the morning. Wiltshire conducted us to a long, deep cut in the railroad. No patrol or picket was in sight. I preferred derailing the train in a cut to running it off an embankment, because there would be less danger of the passengers being hurt. People who travel on a railroad in a country where military operations are going on do take the risk of all these accidents of war. I was not conducting an insurance business on life or property. It was a lovely night, bright and clear, with a big Jack Frost on the ground. I believe that I was the only member of my command who went through the war without a watch. But all my men had watches, and we knew it would not be long before the train would be due. Vedettes were sent out, and the men were ordered to lie down on the bank of the railroad and keep quiet. We had hidden all day and were tired and sleepy. We were soon peacefully dreaming. I laid my head in the lap of one of my men, Kirk Hutchison, and fell asleep. For some reason, I suppose it was because we were sleeping so soundly, we did not hear the train coming until it got up to the cut, and I was aroused and astounded by an explosion and a crash. As we had displaced the rail, the engine had run off the track, but the boiler had burst, and the air was filled with red-hot cinders and escaping steam. A good description of the scene can be found in Dante's Inferno. Above all, could be heard the screams of the passengers, especially the women. The catastrophe came so suddenly that my men at first seemed to be stunned and bewildered. Knowing that the railroad guards would soon hear of it, no time was to be lost. I ran along the line and pushed my men down the bank, ordering them to go to work, pulling out the passengers and setting fire to the cars. By this time, Hutchison had recovered from the shock and had jumped on the train. When the train came up, he was snoring and dreaming that he was in hell. And when he was awakened by the crash, he found himself breathing steam and in a sparkling shower. He had no doubt then that his dream was not all a dream. But he recovered his senses. When I gave him a push, he slid down a bank. It didn't take long to pull out the passengers. While all of this was going on, I stood on the bank giving directions to the men. One of them reported to me that the car was filled with Germans and that they wouldn't get out. I told them, set fire to the car and burn the Dutch if they won't come out. They were immigrants going west to locate homesteads, and they did not understand a word of English or what this all meant. They had through tickets and thought they had a right to keep their seats. There was a lot of New York heralds on the train for Sheridan's army, so my men circulated the papers through the train and applied matches. Suddenly, there was a grand illumination. The Germans now took in the situation and came tumbling all in a pile out of the flames. I hope they all live to be naturalized and get home. They ought not to blame me, but Sheridan. It was his business, not mine, to protect them. While we were helping the passengers to climb the steep bank, one of my men, Cap Maddox, who had been sent off as a cadet to watch the road, came dashing up and cried out that the Yankees were coming. I immediately gave orders to mount quickly and form, and one scout was sent to find out if the report was true. He soon came back and said it was not. Men then dismounted and went to work again. I was very mad with Cab for almost creating a stampede. I told him that I had a good mind to have him shot. Cab was quick-witted, but seeing how angry I was, said nothing then. But he often related the circumstance after the war. His well-harnessed account of it was that I ordered him to be shot at sunrise, and that he had said he hoped it would be a foggy morning, and I was so much amused by his reply that I relented and pardoned him. Years afterward, Cab confessed why he gave the false alarm. He said he heard the noise the train made when it ran off the track and knew the men were gathering the spoils and did not think it was fair to him to be away at picnic for their benefit. He also said that after he got to the burning cars, he made up for some lost time. Now, a great many ludicrous incidents occurred, according to Mosby here. And he relates them all. He says, one lady ran up to me and exclaimed, oh, my father's a Mason. I had no time to say anything, but I can't help it. One passenger claimed immunity for himself on the ground that he was a member of an aristocratic church in Baltimore. Just as Cap dashed up, two of my men, Charlie Deere and West Aldridge, came to me and reported that they had two U.S. paymasters with their satchels of greenbacks. Knowing it would be safer to send them out by a small party, which could easily elude the enemy, one of my lieutenants, Charlie Grogan, was detailed with two or three men to take them over the ridge to our rendezvous. When my men got anything in the shape of pocketbooks, watches, or other valuable articles, I never inquired. I was too busy attending to the destroying of the train to see whatever they did. We left all the civilians, including the ladies, to keep warm the burning cars, and the soldiers were taken with us as prisoners. Among the latter was a young German lieutenant who had just received the commission and was on his way to join his regiment and share in its army. I was attracted by his demeanor, struck up a conversation with him, and rode by him for several miles. He was dressed in a fine beaver cloth overcoat, high boots, and a new hat with gilt cord and tassel. After that, we were pretty well acquainted. I said to him, we have done you no harm. Why did you come over here to fight us? Oh, he said, I only come to learn the art of war. I then left him and rode to the head of the column as the enemy were about. There was a prospect of a fight. Not long before the German came trotting up to join me. There had been such a metamorphosis that I scarcely recognized him. One of my men had exchanged his old clothes with him for his new ones, and he complained about it. I asked him if he had not told me that he came to Virginia to learn the art of war. Yes, he replied. Very well, he said. This is your first lesson. Now it must be thought that the habit of appropriating the enemy's goods was peculiar to my men. Through all ages, it had been the custom of war. Not long after this incident, I had to suffer from the same operation. I was shot at night and stripped of my clothes. 40 years afterward, a lady returned to me the hat which I had been wearing. She said that her uncle, Lieutenant Colonel Coles, of the regiment that captured it, had given it to her as a relic of war. That is war. I am willing to admit, however, that in a statement of mutual accounts at that time, my men were largely in debt to Sheridan's forces. In the end, that's the end of that particular section. At the end, it turned out that they had gotten a lot of money. I think it was somewhere around $74,000, and it had been the pay that was waiting for the Union soldiers, which put some of the Union soldiers in the area into desertion mode. It also had great numbers of Union troops coming out to try to find this Mosby, to repair that train, to get the train off the track, which was a big, big thing. And so all these little things added up, just confounding and confusing the Union forces in the area so that they couldn't use their troop superiority, number superiority, materiel superiority to just devastate the area. So whatever you do to tie up the Union, Mosby did. And after the war, Mosby was a sentimental guy. Robert E. Lee, I think, was beloved to him, and vice versa. Lee had shown great admiration and support for Mosby during the war. Of course, early on, Mosby was an irregular soldier, we'll say, and so he didn't have the pay or the protection that a real soldier would have. So later on, he became a soldier, and Lee always supported any promotions that came along. And after the war, when Mosby wrote this book, he concluded a section of what he thought about Robert E. Lee. I thought it was interesting. Here's Mosby's recollections of General Lee. My first meeting with General Robert E. Lee was in August 1862 when I brought the news of Ambrose Burnside's reinforcement of Pope, a story that I've told in the preceding pages. The next time we met was at his headquarters in Orange, and that's Orange County, Orange City, in Orange County, about 2 months after Gettysburg. But Lee did not seem in the least depressed. He was as buoyant and as aggressive as ever. He took a deep interest in my operations, for there was nothing of the Fabius in his character. Dave, look that one up. There's one. I don't know what that means. There's nothing of the Fabius in his character. Lee was the most aggressive man I met in the war and was always ready for an enterprise. I believe that his interest in me was largely due to the fact that his father, Lightfoot Harriet, was a partisan officer in the American Revolutionary War. After General Stuart was killed in May of 1864, I reported directly to General Lee. During the siege of Petersburg, I visited three times, twice when I was wounded. Once when I got out of the ambulance, he was standing near, talking to General James Longstreet. When he saw me hobbling up to him on crutches, he came to meet me. He introduced me to General Longstreet and said, "Colonel, the only fault I have ever had to find with you is that you are always getting wounded." Such a speech, General Lee, more than repaid me for my wound. The last time I saw him during the war was about 2 months before the surrender. I had been wounded again. He was not only kind, but affectionate, and asked me to take dinner with him, though he said he hadn't much to eat. There was a leg of mutton on the table, but he remarked that some of his staff officers must have stolen it. After dinner, when we were alone, he talked very freely. He said that in the spring of 1862, Joe Johnston, that's General Joe Johnston of the Confederacy, ought not to have fallen back from the Rapidan to Richmond, that he had written, urging him to turn against Washington. He also said that when Joe Johnston evacuated his lines at Yorktown in May of that year, he should have given him battle with his whole force on the Isthmus at Williamsburg instead of making a rear guard fight. When I bade Lee goodbye after our last interview, I had no idea that it was my final parting with him as my commander. I can never forget the sympathetic words with which he cautioned me against unnecessary exposure to danger. The following is the last order he ever gave me. It was dated March 27, 1865, and it put me in command of all of Northern Virginia. "Collect your command and watch the country from the front of Gordonsville to Blue Ridge and also the valley. Your command is all now that is in that section, and the general, General Lee, will rely on you to watch and protect the country. If any of your command is in northern neck, call it to you." That was passed to Mosby from W.H. Taylor, which was an assistant adjutant general of General Lee. Lee was raised in the political school of Washington and Hamilton. In the Virginia Convention of 1788, his father had voted against the imbecile Confederation and for the Constitution, which made the laws of the Union the supreme law of the land, and in 1798 spoke and voted against the famous States' Rights Resolutions. In the year 1794, he commanded the Virginia troops that ordered the Pennsylvania to suppress the Whiskey Insurrection. It is difficult to distinguish in law between Washington's proclamation in 1794, calling out the military force to execute the laws of the United States, and Lincoln's proclamation, 1861, calling out, asking for a draft, I believe, calling out 75,000, asking for 75,000 volunteers. As Lieutenant Colonel of the 2nd Cavalry, Lee was stationed in Texas in February 1861, but was ordered to Washington, arriving there about the time of the presidential inauguration. The Commander-in-Chief, General Scott, the Virginian, was too old for active service. There was then no retirement law, and he wanted Lee near him as an advisor and second in command. On March 16, Colonel Edwin V. Sumner was promoted to a brigadier general in place of Twiggs, who had been dismissed for treachery and surrendering the Union troops in Texas. A Virginia lady who met Lee about that time told me many years ago that he spoke to her with great indignation about General Twiggs' conduct. Lee now became colonel of the 1st Cavalry, as biographers do not seem to have heard of his promotion and ignored the fact that he accepted a commission from President Lincoln. Lee was with his family at Arlington and on confidential relations with the War Department up to the day of his resignation, April 20, 1861, as the command of the U.S. Army was offered to him. Scott must have thought that he would stand by the Union, and Lee's purpose to resign in the event of Virginia passing an ordinance of secession had not been disclosed. Lee was forced by circumstances to take the side for which he fought for in the war. On the subject of slavery and the right of secession, he agreed with Abraham Lincoln. 5 years before, in writing about slavery, he had said, quote, "It is a moral, social, and political evil." Writing at Fort Mason, Texas on January 23, 1861, after seven states passed ordinances of secession, Lee said, quote, "The framers of our Constitution would never have exhausted so much labor, wisdom, and forbearance in its formation and surrounded it with so many safeguards and securities if it was intended to be broken by every member of the Confederacy at will. It was preamble and for establishment of a government, not a compact, which can only be dissolved by revolution or by the consent of all the people in convention assembled. It is idle to talk of secession. Anarchy would have been established and not a government by Washington, Hamilton, Jefferson, Madison, and all the other patriots of the revolution. End quote. When Lee resigned his commission to join the forces of the native state, he acted, as nearly every soldier acts, in personal sympathy with the combatants and not on any legal theory of right and wrong. On the day when he resigned, he wrote to his sister that he could not draw his sword against his family, his neighbors, and his friends. And I think, by the way, as an aside, that pretty much sums up the point of view of many of the Southerners who fought for and fought in the Southern Army. They simply could not draw a sword against their family, their neighbors, and their friends. On the previous day, he happened to go to the store in Alexandria to pay a bill. Lee's heart was burdened with a great sorrow, and he uttered these words, which the merchant wrote down in his journal, and they still stand there today. Lee said, "I must say that I am one of those dull creatures that cannot see the good of secession." End quote. Below this entry, the merchant wrote, spoken by Colonel Robert E. Lee, and he paid his bill, April 19, 1861. A few days later, Lee was made commander-in-chief of the forces of the state of Virginia. There was no competition for the position. Late Judge John Critcher represented Westmoreland, Lee's native county, in the secession convention and was one of the committee sent to notify him of the appointment. The judge told me that when Lee turned, I once heard General John C. Breckinridge say at a dinner in Baltimore, soon after he returned from his exile in Canada, that if the Southern Confederacy had been established, there would have been such a spirit of local self-assertion that every county would have claimed the right to stand up for itself. I met General Lee a few times after the war, but the days of strife were never mentioned. I remember the last words he spoke to me about 2 months before his death at a reception that was given to him in Alexandria. When I bade him goodbye, he said, quote, "Colonel, I hope we shall have no more wars." Quote. In March 1870, I was walking across the bridge connecting the Ballard and Exchange hotels in Richmond, and to my surprise, I met General Lee and his daughter. The general was pale and haggard. He did not look like the Apollo I had known in the Army. After a while, I went to his room, and our conversation was on current topics. I felt impressed by the great memories that his presence revived. While both of us were thinking about the war, neither of us referred to it. After leaving the room, I met General Pickett and told him that I had just been with Lee. He remarked that if I would go with him, he would call and pay his respects to the general, but he did not want to go and be alone with him, so I'm back with Pickett. The interview was cold and formal, and evidently embarrassing to both. It was their only meeting after the war. General Pickett, as you probably know, was the leader of Pickett's Charge, in which at Gettysburg, when all else was failing, Lee ordered a frontal assault on the Union lines. General Pickett led the way, and they were just slaughtered as they came across that field, hit with cannon fire and projectiles and troops. And Pickett always wondered why he had chosen him, and Lee had always wondered if he picked the right guy for it. But so this meeting was very emotional for Pickett. He always wanted to talk to Lee about it. But anyway, it says, in a few minutes, I rose and left the room together with General Pickett. He then spoke very bitterly, General Lee, calling him that old man. "He had my division massacred at Gettysburg," Pickett said. "Well, it made you immortal," I replied. I rather suspect Pickett gave a wrong reason for his unfriendly feelings. In May 1892, University of Virginia, I took breakfast with Professor Venable, who'd been on Lee's staff. He told me that some days before the surrender of Appomattox, General Lee ordered Pickett under arrest. "I suppose the Five Forks affair," I think the professor said that he carried the order. Five Forks, I think, a Pickett command had had gotten caught unawares. Pickett was away from his command at the time in a war zone and had been supping with several officers at a local plantation, and he got back too late to command his troops at Five Forks. I remember very well his adding that on the retreat, Pickett passed them, that General Lee said with deep feeling, "Is that man still with the Army?" I once went to see the tomb of Montcalm in the chapel of the Ursuline Convent at Quebec. When I read the inscription, "Fate denied him victory, but blessed him with a glorious immortality," I recall General Robert E. Lee. Well, I think we have a little time to go over, read a few of the recollections that he had at General Grant. They are a bit longer. I will say this, after the war, General Grant was also looking to heal the wounds of war. Grant was not one to go out and punish these soldiers for fighting for what they believed in. As a matter of fact, at Appomattox, I believe he gave the officers the right to take horses, mules, guns, whatever they needed, and also the regular soldiers may have had to turn their guns in. They may have been allowed to take one for hunting. I can't remember what it was. But generally speaking, the people in the North and some of the politicians thought that Grant's gesture at Appomattox was just too much. This is a subjugated foe which we need to beat down. And Grant and soldiers at the time, most of them, I would hope, had a real gentlemanly treatment of their attitude and treatment towards the vanquished. At any rate, interestingly, Mosby, I think, became a Democrat. He became a Democrat or Republican. Maybe became a Republican. Everybody was Republican. Lincoln was a Republican. I think afterwards, as Rutherford B. Hayes, right, and General Grant, you had Johnson, and you had Grant, and you had more Union generals coming up there, or officers. You had Rutherford B. Hayes, and you had James Garfield. So there was a string of Union officers that were president after Lincoln was assassinated. Johnson didn't run again, I guess. But Grant particularly liked Mosby. And had great admiration for him, and he ended up speaking for him on numerous occasions. At any rate, here's when Mosby first meets General Grant. I first met General Grant in May 1872 after Mr. Greeley had been nominated for the presidency by a convention whose members called themselves liberal Republicans, although, as a matter of fact, many of them had been the most radical elements of the party, but had seceded on account of personal grievances. My home was then at Warrenton, Virginia, where I was practicing law, mostly became a lawyer. As it was only 50 miles from Washington, I was frequently there, but I had only once seen General Grant. One evening at the National Theater, when he was in a box with General Sherman, both men seemed to enjoy the play as much as the gods in the gallery. In common with most Southern soldiers, I had a very kindly feeling towards General Grant, not only on account of his magnanimous conduct at Appomattox, but also for his treatment of me at the close of hostilities. I had never called on him, however. If I had done so, and if he had received me even politely, we should both have been subjected to severe criticism, so bitter was the feeling between the sections at the time. No doubt, in those days, most Northerners believed the imaginative stories of the war correspondents, and supposed that my battalions fought under the black flag. General Grant was as much misunderstood in the South as I was in the North. But time has healed wounds which were once thought to be irremediable. And there is today no memory of our war so bitter, probably, as the Scottish recollection of Culloden. That was the slaughter of the Scots at Culloden by the Brits. Like most Southern men, I had disapproved Reconstruction measures and was sore and very rested by the military government. But since my prejudices have faded, and now see that many things which we regarded as being prompted by hostile and vindictive motives were actually necessary in order to prevent anarchy and secure the freedom of newly emancipated slaves. I had given little attention to politics and had devoted my time to my profession, although I was under no political disability. As we had all been opposed to the Republican Party before the war, it was a point of honor to keep on voting that way. When Horace Greeley was nominated, I saw, or I thought I saw, that it was idle to divide longer upon issues which we acknowledged to have been legally, if not properly, settled. and that if the Southern people wanted reconciliation, as they said they did, the logical thing to do was to vote for Grant. I have not changed my opinion, nor yet have I any criticism to make of those who differed with me. We were all working for the same end. Some said they couldn't sacrifice their principles for Grant's friendship. I didn't sacrifice mine. Not long before the death, the late General M.C. Butler, United States Senator from South Carolina, I met him on the street in Washington. "We ought to have gone with you for Grant," he said. My views and opinions of that period are set forth in the following interview published in the Richmond Enquirer, January 1873. Reporter says to Mosby, "As he had stated generally that you have some influence with General Grant, is this true?" Mosby says, "I don't know what amount of influence I may have with the president, but General Grant knows the fiery ordeal I have been through here of supporting him, and I suppose he has some appreciation of it." Porter, "What is the policy that you have advocated for the Virginia people?" Colonel Mosby, "The issues that formerly divided the Virginia people from the Republican Party were those growing out of the Reconstruction measures. Last year, the Virginia people agreed to make no further opposition to those measures and to accept all questions growing out of them as settled. There being no longer any questions, then, on principles separating Virginia people from General Grant, it became a mere matter of policy and expediency whether they would support him or Horace Greeley. I thought it was the first opportunity the Southern people had had to restore their proper relation and influence with the federal administration. In other words, I said the Southern statesmen ought to avail themselves of this opportunity to support General Grant for re-election and thereby acquire influence and control over his administration. That was the only way I saw of displacing the carpetbag crew that represented the government in the Southern states. I think that events have demonstrated I was right." What he is saying there, Mosby is saying, is that he spoke out in support of Grant, and he was nearly run out of Virginia because to support the Republicans, to support General Grant particularly, was nearly a suicidal thing. I think he was shot at. He was practically run out of the state, even with his great reputation. But back to the interview. The reporter says, "Has the president ever tended to you any position under his administration?" Mosby said, "Shortly after the presidential election, the president said something to me on the subject of giving me an office. I told him while I would hold an office under him, as under any other man who had ever been president, that there was no office within his gift that I had desired or would accept. I told him that my motives in supporting him had been assailed, and my accepting a position under his administration would be regarded as a confirmation of the truth of the charge that I was governed by selfish motives. My principal reason for not accepting anything from him was that I would have far more influence for good by taking nothing for myself." Reporter says, "Colonel, I have heard you are now promoting claims against the government. Is that a fact?" Mosby concludes, "It is not. I have filed one claim for a citizen before the Southern Claims Commission. I shall turn this over, however, to a claim agent. I have had hundreds of claims of all sorts for prosecution against the government offered me, but have declined them all, as I have no idea of bartering my political influence. I do not think that any man nominated at Lynchburg will stand the most remote chance of success, because he will only be supported by the blacks, the Negroes of the state, led by a few white men. No matter what my relations to the administration may be, I wouldn't assist in putting this set in power." I'm looking here. There's a time when Mosby did show up at the White House. Back at the time, people would show up at the White House once Grant was elected. And they just sat there and they waited all day. The 4 hours of the president's day would be spent talking to people. "Hey, I've got my dog was killed by this guy." It was kind of like a people's court. You'd go in there and the president would be thinking to himself, "I have so many more important things to do than these small things." But it was a custom that remained, I think, all the way through Garfield. They may have done away with it at that point in time, since one of the people who was constantly waiting to see Garfield was the man who assassinated him. So it appears this assassin was sitting inside the White House on numerous occasions. So they had a problem after Garfield's assassination. They did away with this. But at the time, Grant would see anybody. But General Grant people that time, and he'd like to hear from Mosby. Now, Mosby goes on in the book to say, I had strong personal reasons for being friendly with General Grant. If he had not thrown his shield over me, I should have been outlawed and driven into exile. When Lee surrendered, my battalion was in Northern Virginia on the Potomac, 100 miles from Appomattox. Secretary of War Stanton invited all soldiers in Virginia to surrender on the same conditions which were offered to Lee's army, but I was accepted. General Grant, who was then all-powerful, interposed, sent me an offer of the same parole that he had given General Lee, such a service I could never forget. When the opportunity came, I remembered what he had done for me, and I did all I could for him. Early one morning, a few days after the election of 1872, I had to go to the Treasury Department on business. Secretary, Mr. Boothwell, had not come, and I was waiting in an anteroom. To my surprise, General Grant walked in, shook hands with me, and said, I heard you were here and came to thank you for my getting the vote of Virginia. That is the only time I ever saw a president in any of the departments. Of course, I appreciated General Grant's compliment, although he gave me credit for a great deal more than I deserved. General Grant had also done another thing that showed the generosity of his nature. A few weeks before the surrender, a small party of my men crossed the Potomac one night and got into a fight in which a detective was killed. One of the men was captured and sent to Fort McHenry. After the war, he was tried by a military commission and sentenced to be imprisoned. The boy's mother went to see President Johnson to beg a pardon for her son. Johnson repelled her roughly. In her distress, she went over to the War Department to see General Grant. Listened patiently to her sorrowful story, then rose and asked her to go with him. He took her to the White House. He walked into the reception room and told the president there had been suffering enough, and they did not leave the room without a pardon for the young Southerner. Johnson signed the necessary paper. In spite of the parole that I had taken, after I had settled down to practice the law, I was several times arrested by provost marshals stationed at the courthouses when I went on the circuit. This was both annoying and unfair. My parole was a contract with the governor that was binding on both parties. To arrest me before I had violated it was a breach. As my wife passed through Washington on her way to Baltimore, she determined to go to the White House, not to ask for a pardon, but to make a complaint. She had not intimated her purpose to me. Her father, President Johnson, had served in Congress together and had been friends. But she told Johnson, whose daughter, whose wife she was. Instead of responding kindly, he was rude to her. She left him, went to see General Grant, and he treated her as courteously as if she had been the wife of a Union soldier, and then wrote the following letter she gave to her. He did not dictate the letter to McClurk. The whole is in his small, neat handwriting. It gave me liberty to travel anywhere unmolested as long as I had served my parole. Well, Dave, there's much more to this book, and it's a very interesting book and can be purchased from the Barnes Review. Barnes Review is a history magazine, politically incorrect. This particular book may or may not continue to be published in the shape it's in. It's a very nice book, but on the front cover, we've got a Confederate flag. And we all know that anything that displays the Confederate flag means Amazon might not take it. So I would suggest that people would like to get a copy of the memoirs of Colonel John S. Mosby, published by the Barnes Review, which is the preeminent edition, including not only the foreword from the original editor of the piece, but also a lengthy introduction by Stanley Rittenhouse, who is a supporter of the Barnes Review, an historian, and also a citizen of the Warrington area, which Mosby was active in. Or you can order this book. If you don't go to Amazon, you can just go to www.barnesreview.com, look up Memoirs of Mosby, and you'll see it's there, $25. It's great stuff. I mean, he goes through the details of, he defends Stuart's actions at Gettysburg. You know, Stuart has always taken a lot of heat for disappearing in the Battle of Gettysburg when he was trying to collect intelligence, and Mosby stuck up for it to the end because Mosby was allowed access to private papers, which other people didn't care about, and he found the letters of Lee and Jackson, or was it Lee and Longstreet? Maybe Lee and Longstreet, and they had basically ordered Stewart to do what he did, and he may have gone a circuitous route, but he certainly wasn't responsible for the loss at the speed of Gettysburg. So Mosby sticks up for his old pal, Jeb Stuart. He talks about other raids that he went on surprising, a little more of a detail about the surprising of General Stoughton, capturing that, his beliefs on things, the feelings that he had for his wife and his family, and the tender letters, but also the strict disciplinarian that he was with his own men, and the inspiration that he was for that television program in 1957, which I said would never appear again. So if you want to get a copy of Mosby's memoirs while you can, before they're outlawed and banned, go to the Barnes & Noble and get them. Dave, are you still with me?
I'm always here, Paul. You know that.
What are you working on? You're working on the American Free Press website.
I'm working on everything. Yeah, I am.
We had an ad for the most people there too. I think if we all wrap it up by saying that, you know, these guys, if you listen to what most he's saying, yeah, you don't hear a lot of hatred in his voice. His letters don't mention slavery much. They don't really talk about that. I mean, I think he owned slaves. I'm not sure if he ever was in a position to do so. He had accumulated some wealth. His wife was wealthy, but she had family in Baltimore, evidently. And it's a different world, it's a different time, it's a different aesthetic, it's a different morality. And, you know, even in the midst of the Civil War, in which these guys were slaughtering each other every day and right and left, they still somehow kept their humanity. And so, you know, I'd really like to know what some of these guys would think about what's going on today, because to see their battle flag treated in such a fashion, to see the preconception that people have about what they thought about the South and what they wanted for the future of America, I think they'd just be astounded, as would say Adolf Hitler be astounded if he were to see what was being said about him today. We need more eyewitness accounts of what was going on there, too. And to say that this particular battle flag of the Confederacy or even the first, second, and third national flags or symbols of hate, it's kind of ridiculous. I guess that's the way it's going to go. I don't want to say goodbye to it. I think we should do what we can do without risking the lives of our families, of course, if that one poor individual had to do, you know, to educate people about this topic, to let them read the words of real Confederate gentlemen, soldiers. Believe me, not all of them were perfect. But is there anything you'd like to say in conclusion, Dave?
Well, no, just that there were three black cops in Baltimore and three white. We talked about that earlier on. And you mentioned Fabius.
Yes.
Yeah, that refers to this Fabius Maximus, who was a Roman politician and general. And what it means, basically, without going too much into it, is cautious, to be cautious. The Fabian Society, from the members' belief in slow rather than revolutionary change in government.
Well, that's very helpful. Now I've learned something, because I've heard that, and I kind of pretended or thought I knew what it meant, but now I understand what the Fabian Society is and what that means. Thank you, Colonel John S. Mosby. Well, listen, when you go down to your League of the South rally, are they looking for people to attend? Is this a closed event? Do they want people from the town to come? What's the story?
Yeah, well, I mean, the League
are
of
they
the South. Go ahead.
Are they only members?
Well, the annual convention is open to anyone. There are some parts of it that are not, but most of it is. And of course, this event, if all you have to do is go to leagueofthesouth.com and you can see what we're talking about there. Yeah. But yeah, they people can show up. It's going to be in Wetumpka, Alabama. And I don't know much about Wetumpka, except what I found out is there's a casino there. I think it's called Wind Creek.
Keep yourself out of that casino.
I don't gamble.
You are for your money.
What money?
Well, listen, let's just go ahead then and give the date of that again.
Yes, that is coming up this week. It starts Friday, the 24th, and it ends on the 25th. So.
And so we'll see a report about that in pages of American Free Press, and it'll probably be posted on AmericanFreePress.net. Well, let's wrap her up. We'll see you next week.